Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast. This week, I have the pleasure of chatting with two guests from University College London, Professor Steve Fleming and Dr. Nadina Dykstra. Professor Fleming is the Wellcome Trust Royal Society Sir Henry Dale Fellow at the Department of Experimental Psychology and Principal Investigator at the Wellcome Center for Human Neuroimaging, where he leads the Metacognition Group. He has received numerous awards for his work, including the William James Prize from the Association for Scientific Study of Consciousness. Dr. Dykstra is a senior research fellow at the Wellcome Center for Human Neuroimaging at University College London. She obtained her PhD in artificial intelligence at the Donders Institute in 2019, after which she moved to London to pursue a postdoc at UCL with Professor Fleming. In this episode, Dr. Dykstra and Professor Fleming take us into the fascinating realm of how we distinguish, or at least attempt to distinguish, reality from imagination. They relate the details of a recent study, which indicates that our perceptions of reality might not be as different from our imaginations as we would like to believe. They suggest that this framework of perceptual reality monitoring could be a lens through which our brains interpret all of our experiences. In fact, this perceptual reality monitoring framework might provide an explanation of how we consciously experience the world. After discussing their recent experiment and relating it to the broader field of consciousness science, each of them shares details about their career journeys and their hopes for the future of the field. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today, everyone. I'm looking forward to our discussion on the relationship between reality and imagination. We're planning to start our conversation by focusing on the groundbreaking 2023 Nature Communications paper, Subjective Signal Strength Distinguishes Reality from Imagination. Before we get into the specifics of the paper, let me start more generally with a question about the field. Many of us believe we can readily distinguish reality from what we imagine. Is that assumption an accurate one?
Yes, so there's been quite some research over the last decade or so that shows that when we internally generate a visual experience, like when we imagine something, when we remember something, think about the future, then actually very similar brain areas become active as when we would actually experience that in reality. So I say, imagine being on a beach. Something very similar happens in the brain as when if I would actually be on the beach. And there's also quite some research that shows that maybe part of what we perceive in reality, part of that is actually filled in or imagined based on our own experiences. So within the brain, imagination and reality does seem to be quite mixed up together. But whether we can actually distinguish those very well or not was something that was still unclear, and our study tried to directly investigate that.
Excellent. So it sounds like that assumption really isn't an accurate one, and that reality and imagination might be closer than we would like to believe. In terms of the study you conducted for this experiment, how were you investigating that? What was your central question here?
Yeah, so we were really inspired by this idea that the brain does something similar when we imagine something as when we would actually see it. And we were wondering whether that had any consequences. It might be that the brain does something similar, but for some reason, we are still able to keep the two apart very well. And there's one study that was done all the way back in 1910 by Mary Chiefs West-Berkey. And she showed anecdotal evidence that people can mistake or confuse their imagination and reality. And we wanted to address that in a more modern version in our experiment. So the key thing that Berkey did is that she asked people to imagine objects while looking at a location on the wall. So these people were invited to come back to her lab. This was in the US. And then they were imagining these objects. But then what she did is she had hidden away this magical projection lantern, which is like a projector, but a very old-fashioned projector. They didn't have computers then, right? And she used this projector to project shapes on the same location of the wall that were in line with what people were imagining. So say somebody was imagining an apple. And she used this projector to also present a red circle at exactly the same location. But people didn't know that these chips were presented to them. So what happened is that they mistook these presentations to be the result of their imagination. Suddenly saying things like, well, my imagination is so vivid. I didn't know I could do this. People were really surprised by how vividly they could imagine. They couldn't, right? Because it was actually presented, but they didn't know that. So there was a study that kind of indicated that maybe people do mistake imagination and reality actually in daily life. But this study hadn't really been replicated. Results were very mixed. And also the study itself, they only did a few trials and a few participants. There were no real stats. So it's really hard to draw any firm conclusions based on that study. So we wanted to create a modern version. And the important thing here is that you want to have maximal statistical power, but you also don't want people to know that something can be presented to them. And the problem is, if you do hundreds and hundreds of trials, which is what we usually do in psychophysics and psychology, once they see a stimulus once, they're going to be biased on all future trials, right? They're going to look for stimuli. So we came up with a very smart trick, which is based on what Steve has done in previous studies as well, is letting each participant only do once. Trials, so one trial per participant, and then just measure hundreds and hundreds of trials. So that's what we did.
And in the beginning of the paper, you outlined the three hypotheses you have about how this critical test of this one trial at the end might reveal more about how we represent reality and imagination, how we distinguish. What were those different scenarios?
So we had three hypotheses. The first hypothesis is kind of a null model. And it says maybe we do find this overlap in the brain, but in actuality, it's very easy to dissociate reality and imagination. So that could be into many different reasons. For example, maybe imagery activates different layers of the visual cortex, where there's just some kind of telltale sign that we can use. And when we, if we would look into the brain more carefully, we would be able to see it. So that's our null hypothesis. Basically, we can completely distinguish imagination and reality. And then our kind of first interesting hypothesis is based on this Purkey effect. And that says that if you imagine the same thing as what you're seeing, you're going to ascribe your perception to imagery. So you would mistake your perception for imagination. So that means that if you're imagining the same thing as perceiving it, you're less likely to detect an external stimulus. And then the final hypothesis is basically saying, no, we do activate exactly the same brain regions and the same neurons when we imagine and perceive, but that's not a problem because during imagery, the activation is much weaker. So the way that we decide whether something is real or not is just by looking at how strong those signals are. So the kind of key contrast in our study is that we asked people to imagine specific stimuli. And then on the last trial or the kind of the critical trial, like you mentioned, we presented either the same stimulus or a different stimulus. And then if you have the first model, that's the null hypothesis, then it shouldn't matter whether you presented the same or a different stimulus. It shouldn't influence your reality judgments at all. Whereas if you have the Purkey model, the kind of suppression idea, then if you present the same stimulus, you should be less likely to detect it because you're going to ascribe it to your imagination. And then the final model says if you're imagining and perceiving the same stimulus, you should be more likely to detect it because your imagery and perception are completely intermixed. So that's the idea.
I think one really exciting thing about the study is the hypotheses that Nadina outlines are very rooted in how we think the brain works and potential computational models underpinning perception and reality monitoring. But as Nadina mentioned, the design of this study, it was just really hard to get at that using standard tools of psychophysics because of this expectation issue. And so I think that one of the really amazing things that we have available now is this ability to do very large-scale studies over the web with hundreds, if not thousands of people. And then you could essentially, I still find this remarkable, really. You can test these pretty precise computational hypotheses remotely in a large population. Essentially, everyone is doing just a very short experiment.
In terms of this sort of revolutionary design of being able to use all of these subjects to make this one critical trial at the end so that they're not expecting to see a real stimulus when they think they're supposed to be imagining a stimulus. What did you find? What were the results here?
So our results were just very cleanly in line with our last hypothesis, so the sensory strength hypothesis. Basically, when people were imagining the same thing as we presented to them, they were more likely to say that they saw a real stimulus. And the interesting bit is that we also asked people to rate their vividness of their imagination. when we presented these real signals to them, they also said that suddenly their imagination was more vivid. So it really seemed that these signals were combined together to create one strong experience. And if that experience was strong, then it means that people say their imagination was strong, even though part of that was perception. And they also say that it's real, even though part of that was imagination. So really suggesting that these two signals are completely mixed together in your brain.
And that also has these implications, not just for how we think about reality monitoring, but there's interesting implications for consciousness, just theories of how consciousness emerges. Hak Kwon Lau, who is a neuroscientist based in Japan, has put forward this theory that he calls perceptual reality monitoring theory. And the idea there is our conscious experience is rooted in some mechanism that is constantly trying to test. Is something real or is it just internally generated or internal noise? And there's been an open question about how would that mechanism work? And one proposal that came from Hak Kwon's side is that essentially the brain has a three-way switch. It's trying to say, is it imagined? Is it real? Or is it just noise? And then another model that we've been working with for the past few years says that perhaps it's just a two-way switch. Perhaps the brain is just estimating the strength of the signal and attributing it either to reality or internal generations. There are results from Nadina's study suggest that perhaps the two-way switch model is supported by those data. There's other ways to test the hypothesis as well. So the idea here is that it doesn't just have implications for how we think about imagination, but also how we might construct conscious experience more broadly.
In terms of that idea about perceptual reality monitoring being a possible mechanism of consciousness or a possible gateway to consciousness, how does that work? Can you expand a little bit upon what the mechanisms are there?
Yeah, so I think we don't really know what the mechanisms are. The theory is relatively broad and conceptual. It is potentially consistent with lots of different ways of actually implementing perceptual reality monitoring. But the core idea is that if you have a system like the mind that is able to simulate and internally generate things, we can imagine things that are not really there. We can carry out a whole bunch of offline stuff like dreaming as well and so on. Then there's some evolutionary imperative to avoid confusion. Imagine that there is internally generated outputs for the external environment. So we only want to rely on and treat as real things that are coming in from the outside world. And so the idea then is that this is what we call consciousness. The folk psychology of consciousness is really saying that we attribute some external reality, we rely on it to act in the world. The brain has this mechanism, and when it classifies something as being real rather than imagined, then that is what we call consciousness.
That's really fascinating. And in terms of that, is this theory compatible with some of the other major theories of consciousness in the field, or does this really stand alone as a competing theory?
It's one of a class of theories known as higher order theories, where the idea is that what's doing the work in creating conscious experience is some kind of higher order representation that's monitoring ongoing perceptual processing and tagging it in certain ways. And perceptual reality monitoring theory says that the tag that makes a difference is whether that internal representation is considered to reflect external reality. And then it also says that is then used for the rational control of action. We attribute it what philosophers call assertoric force. So we cannot unsee it. It's presented to us, and no matter how much we get told it might not be real, we just feel it is definitely real. So that's a version of a higher order theory of consciousness. And that is distinct from other ways of thinking about conscious experience, like first order theories, which would say that you don't need any of this higher order machinery, that conscious experience is inherent to the perceptual representation itself, or global workspace theory, which says that that first order representation gets broadcast throughout the brain. There's a long discussion we could have about how there's elements of those theories that might all be compatible, but the perceptual reality monitoring theory is more compatible with the higher order view.
In terms of the paper itself, it sounds like the main result suggests that it's more about signal strength in terms of distinguishing reality from imagination, but the underlying signals might have very similar architecture. And based on that, I'm wondering if we can dive a little bit deeper into the neuroimaging results of the study. Your study highlights three different brain regions, among others: the pre-supplementary motor cortex, the anterior insula, and the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex as key regions in terms of your neuroimaging results. What are these regions generally involved in, and why might activities in these regions correlate with imagery vividness and perceptual visibility in the study?
So I think before we go into these frontal regions, I want to highlight the role of the sensory cortex here, because I think that's important as well. But in general, we find when we look at the correlates of imagery vividness, is you see that it correlates with how perception-like neural representations are in visual cortex. So the more you are able to re-instantiate a representation in visual cortex that seems like perception, the more vivid your experience during imagery is, which intuitively makes a lot of sense. But that's a more complicated analysis. And these brain regions that you just mentioned, those are the ones that showed correlates with just signal in the bulk signal. It's like probably they're also very important for determining the vividness and the visibility. And maybe these higher order areas are the ones that are actually reading out this more precise representation in visual cortex.
Interpreting what these prefrontal regions are doing is difficult. One tempting interpretation, as Nadina says, it's reading out something about the precision or strength about the perceptual representation. So that would be very compatible with what we were just discussing, this higher order idea of tagging a first order representation with precision. But this is univariate, bold activity, and then looking across classifications and multiple patterns of voxels. So it's a long way from the circuit and how that might be interfacing with the visual representation. So there are lots of other influences on that activity, for instance. So you could imagine that this kind of general feeling of something being vivid or visible is also related to processes involved in arousal or attention. So I think we can't really distinguish those, but what we can say very clearly, which fits nicely with the model in the behavioral part of the paper, is that whatever those signals are that are driving up and down visibility in the perceptual case are similar signals to what ones that are correlating with vividness in the imagery case. So we don't really know what the source of the signals are, how they work, but they seem to be similar, which is an important piece of evidence.
In terms of the implications of the study, it sounds like maybe because some of the signals provoked by real stimuli and imagined stimuli might be similar, as evidenced both by the behavioral results and the neuroimaging results. What might that mean for our current understanding of mental health or reliability of testimony in court cases? How well are we able to distinguish between reality and imagination? How well can we trust our own perception of reality?
That's a very interesting question. So it's hard, obviously, to draw very far-reaching conclusions based on one study. I think there are quite a lot of studies that do seem to suggest that our perception of reality is very subjective, right? For example, in the case of witness testimonies, these can be influenced by many, many different things. So I think there's evidence to suggest that our brains are not like cameras. We are not passively recording what's happening to us. We are actively interpreting that based on our beliefs, our expectations, our motivations. And I think our study just kind of highlights how far that reaches, how that we can actually, you know, fundamentally even mistake imagination for perception in the extreme case. And in terms of mental health, you could think of with setting this reality threshold, for example, with setting the threshold that says this is imagined and this is real. For example, in hallucinations or psychosis, the threshold is not being set correctly. That could be one thing that's happening. But again, more research is needed to really draw an interim conclusion based on.
Yeah, and I think that one striking implication of this comes out of a recent study that Nadine has conducted looking a similar paradigm with confidence estimates. We probably have less insight than we like to think into these influences. The fact that these top-down effects, this internal imagery is shaping what we attribute as real, is likely to be kind of operating in the background all the time to some degree, and is probably very difficult to realize that on the fly. And in the normal, in the course of going about our daily lives, that's probably not problematic because we're not usually doing what Nadina did and set up a very precise scenario where you're imagining exactly the same thing as you're being presented. But you could imagine future cases where, like with augmented reality, with VR, which has got some seat into the outside world, that there's going to be increasing cases where the kind of information we're being presented with is ambiguous as to whether it really is out there or is part of the virtual world that we're increasingly incorporating into daily life. So I think that gives us pause for thought. It might actually be more difficult than we like to think to unravel whether we're being driven by things that are virtual and things that are real.
I think what our study and other research really shows is that there's no tag, right? Like once you're in the skull, once things are in the brain, it's just electrical activity. It's all mixed together. It's a complicated problem to solve to determine the source of that activity. It's just not automatic or obvious.
Or maybe there is a tag, but it's based on the strength, right? So there's,
yeah.
There may be a mechanism for tagging. It's just not tagging it accurately all the time because it's being driven by something orthogonal to the ground truth.
It's an inference process and something kind of around that process, basically. It's not full core.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've mentioned a little bit about how this study might have implications for the future, for example, in a world where virtual reality becomes more common, where some of these currently self-generated sensory signals might become, or we might be able to create something similar using virtual reality or brain stimulation. What are the next steps for this work in that future?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that we're looking at. So this is obviously a behavioral study. So the next logical thing is to look at what happens in the brain, which is challenging again, because it's a one trial experiment. You can't really do one trial in an MRI scanner. So we're adjusting and trying to look at ways to test it in a brain scanner. And another thing is kind of what you hinted at is this brain stimulation idea. It's there might be a way to directly enhance imagined signals using brain stimulation. And that would be really interesting to see if that then actually leads to us experiencing imagination more as a meal. That's all very speculative and more work needs to be done. And another thing that I would also like to look at is we suggest that these control signals are maybe not important. Well, I think we can't really conclude that based on one study. So I think it would be good to see if that's really the case. If these control signals that we have when we actively imagine something, we know we're doing it, we have this intention, whether that really is not used. So that's another thing I think would be really important to go into more as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this, as we were talking about, this has creates for us a theoretical testing theoretical models of conscious experience, of extending out the computational models we have that are trying to instantiate these higher order representations and think about how they might be monitoring these first order properties and how that might be related to setting this reality threshold. So that's one theoretical avenue that we're interested in. And something that I'm getting increasingly interested in, relation to that is, can we bridge more to the circuit level? And this will probably require collaborations with people working in animal models. So at UCL, we have a colleague of ours, Katarina Schmack, is working on mouse models of confidence in perception and has really cool ways of measuring confidence in what seems to be a false percept, like a hallucination-like perception. So if we could try and create scenarios where we can essentially give the same tasks to the humans and the mice, and then look at how in the humans that's tightly linked to the generation of conscious experience. And then we can reverse infer what circuits might be driving that in the mouse. So that's pretty exciting to connect back to mechanism.
And another thing, I guess, is related to what Steve just mentioned, is if indeed it's really important to tag things as real or not for whether we are going to act on those. And another thing is to see whether, you know, whether these explicit judgments of reality of imagined signals also lead to changes in action. So do people actually treat these things as if they're real? Are they going to act on that evidence in interesting ways? which our confidence results just suggest that they probably will, but this is something that we can explicitly test. And that then really comes more into the territory of what you would see in psychosis and hallucinations, that people adjust their behavior based on actually imagined realities.
That's a cool idea. Should do that. Just create a study live on air.
Right on the podcast. Perfect. You've alluded to your confidence results a couple of times. I'm wondering if you can expand a little bit more about the experimental setup there.
Yeah, of course. So one kind of natural question that we had when we did this study is, okay, people have these kind of false alarms. Sometimes they think something is real when actually nothing was presented. We also did a variation of the study where nothing was presented, and people still sometimes think that they actually really see their imagined stimulus. So we were like, okay, but are people actually confident in that? Or is it more like a guess? Is it more like, yeah, maybe it's there, but they don't really see it. They don't really believe that it's there. It's more like a guess, like, you know, how you can also sometimes guess things in perception detection. You're like, oh, I'm not really sure where it's there. So what we did is we measured confidence following detection judgments, and then we had different predictions. You know, maybe people are more likely to say they see something, but they're actually very uncertain when they say that. But that's not what we found. So we found that people are highly confident that something was really there when they were imagining it, even more than when they were not imagining. So the false alarms during perception without imagination were lower confident than the false alarms during imagination. So yeah, that's really interesting and surprising.
Yeah, and perhaps a bit disconcerting as well in terms of our own fidelity of self-insight.
Yeah, I think so. But this good news, I guess, after the experiment, we asked participants, hey, you know, you did this task and you were imagining these things sometimes. How do you think your imagination influenced your responses? So we asked kind of global insight after the experiment. And we found that people actually know how their imagination, abstractly, explicitly, after the fact, they can explain how this worked kind of well enough. So they were like, yes, I was imagining the same stimulus. I was more likely to say it was there. And if I was imagining a different one, it didn't make a difference. But interestingly, while they were doing it, they were very confident that they saw something that wasn't there. So this is a puzzle, and it suggests that you can have insight at different levels. So it might really feel super real in the moment, but then when you stop to think about it after the fact, you can kind of reason yourself out of it. Maybe that's one option.
That's absolutely fascinating. And it sounds like there's a lot of fruitful space for potential further inquiry in terms of testing whether people really act on these judgments and on their confidence there. And it sounds like they're a number of open questions that can continue to be investigated. I'd like to take a step back from the specific work to ask you a little bit about your lives and your journeys into science. For each of you, what was your journey into science, and how did you become interested in the topics you study today?
My journey into science was really triggered after leaving high school. I really didn't know what I wanted to do when I left school, so I took some time off and worked for a law firm in my hometown and just like doing admin. And then I went traveling and I coached sport and I played a lot of music, and I was thinking I might want to be a musician, and I was like all set to kind of go and study at this Institute for Performing Arts. And I, at that very last minute, I pulled out my application from going there, because while I'd been traveling, I'd also been reading these popular science books on cognitive science and had no idea that this field of psychology existed, and which is partly also why then when I got the opportunity, I really wanted to write a popular science book myself, because I was thinking like that it was exactly those kind of books that got me going here. And then really from that point, that was the point where I thought, this is a fascinating area. I had no idea that a science of the mind was possible, and went to study experimental psychology in Oxford. And while I was there, I had a tutor, Paul Lazzapardi, who's still a researcher in Oxford, and he ran this short course on signal detection theory and consciousness. And really, that's essentially what I've been doing ever since. It was just an 8-week course in my third year undergrad. And the questions that Paul posed in that course, I've just kind of been pursuing ever since then.
You should email them the answers.
Well, yeah, no, we haven't got the answers.
still.
He came to ASD this year. So that was lovely because we attended a conference together for the first time. So that was really nice.
That is wonderful. And for our listeners who might not be familiar, ASSC is the Association for Scientific Study of Consciousness.
I actually studied psychology with the idea that I would become a therapist and clinical psychologist because I wanted to help people. But then I had a class on cognitive neuroscience and I was like, what? Our dreams are caused by electrical signals in our brain? How is that possible? Like all of what we experience is just neurons firing. I literally remember being in that lecture hall and just being like, nah. Like so completely blown away by this mere fact that it's just electrical signals in your brain. And then I started taking a course of philosophy of mind, explanatory gap, and I annoyed my friends to no end with just being endlessly fascinated about this. And they're like, I think it's not that interesting. I don't see the problem. It's a huge problem. How is it possible? I immediately switched tracks to cognitive neuroscience. And then I learned a little bit about AI as well. I did my PhD in an AI lab and I learned that you can actually also formalize these things in maths. And that's even more beautiful, like formalize imagination and reality monitoring in maths, something very elegant about that. And then say something so profound about our experience in such kind of concrete, formal terms. I just fell in love with the science of it. Just like, that's amazing.
I should also say that when Nadina walked into my office in, when was it, 2019, 2018? It's full of pandemic.
13.
That was a very exciting day because ever since then, essentially, I have just been on Nadina's coattails while she's taken this work on imagination and reality monitoring forward. So I've been very lucky to have her in the lab for so long. It's been wonderful.
Well, I've been very lucky to have a very good mentor. So that's also wonderful.
Lovely. So one of the things that we're very happy about in this podcast is that we have a lot of young scientists and folks from a general audience who are interested in science. What advice would you give either yourself at a younger age or some of these young scientists who are listening to the podcast?
I think I would say, you know, there's obviously lots of things to say about that. One salient thing that I often think doesn't always come across is this kind of work takes quite a long time to pay off. And sometimes science in our field feels frenetic and fast, partly due to social media and conferences and people announcing things all the time. It's actually not really, right? So behind the scenes, if you have a project and something you're interested in that's worth doing, usually it can take quite a while and maybe several studies to really build up that body of work. Gives you insight into how something might be working. And so I think it's easy to feel like you're not on the right track because you're always looking around at what everyone else is doing and feeling like things are fast and moving. But often it can be a good idea early, especially early in your career, once you've found the thing you're interested in, just kind of keep your head down and stick at it because it does take a while to pay off sometimes.
Yeah, I think my advice would be very related to that is really follow your excitement and enthusiasm and let that be your driver, because the external rewards in science are super hard to predict. And it could be that not that your projects work out or nobody really cares for some reason about your work. So you really want to be motivated by just your own curiosity at figuring this thing out. And also if that's your motivator and if you find unexpected results, you're going to be still interested. You're going to be like, oh, how does it work then? Whereas if your motivation is just to publish papers, you're going to be annoyed. So I think it's really hard. I know we all also want job security and grants, so it's hard. But I think it makes for a much happier science life if you can keep getting your motivation from your actual curiosity.
Well, that's an inspiring message to be motivated by your passion and interest in the subject. That's really wonderful. In terms of sort of your passion and interest for the subject, what do you hope for the future of your research specifically, and then also the field at large?
Well, I guess I can go for the field at large. I mean, it does worry me sometimes. I oscillate between being optimistic about consciousness science as a field and the ASSC. As you mentioned, Julia is like the flagship conference in our field. And this year, especially, it was very well attended. It seemed in excellent health. And at the same time, I also worry that the public perception of consciousness science and the kind of thing that people outside our fields, and not just outside neuroscience completely, but even neighboring disciplines like vision science, more mainstream neuroscience, and so on, looks upon consciousness science as being not very serious and sometimes talking nonsense. And to be honest, I think sometimes people do talk nonsense in consciousness science. So I think that, like, my hope for the field is that we just increasingly get more of an empirical grounding, and that there's some often wacky ideas that come from, like, theories that suggest that there's just a very low probability of a potentially the whole universe being conscious, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's the kind of thing that we need to avoid talking about so much, and just focusing more on the empirical science that is more allied with mainstream neuroscience.
I've a bit smaller aspirations for my own research at the moment, rather than changing the whole consciousness field. I think for my research personally, we already talked about this a little bit, but I think it can have quite far-reaching consequences for society, how we understand human experiences, both in ill mental health and also just in general experience. So I'd like to focus more on real-world applications, maybe VR, work with patients, make really bridging that gap between our kind of abstract theorizing in our ivory tower and how people actually live their lives. That's one of my goals for the next few years.
That's some wonderful messages about both the specific research and then the field at large, in terms of really bringing things to the real world, as well as trying to base things in empirical research and really making consciousness science as rigorous as possible so that it becomes more compatible and more serious in the eyes of other cognitive neuroscientists. Well, it's been such a pleasure.
No, it's been great. Thanks so much. It's been really nice.
Yeah, thank you so much for organizing this. And these were really interesting questions. It was really, really interesting. Bye.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure for me, and I'm sure for all of our listeners, to hear about this fascinating work and everything that you're doing. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. We would love to hear what you think of this episode or our podcast in general, or if you have any other suggestions for future guests or topics for the podcast. Please feel free to leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this podcast. This podcast has been a labor of love by several wonderful young folks here in the department, and we've been surprised by the ever-increasing reach the podcast has had. We're near 500,000 downloads in a year and a half since we started, with tens of thousands of new downloads and thousands of new followers each month in nearly every country around the world. Please help us make even more people excited about psychology by leaving us a review or subscribing to our no spam, all fun Substack at Stanford Psych Pod to connect with other listeners, or shoot us an email with your thoughts or suggestions at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you once again, and have a wonderful day.